Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Okay, you are back in the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, sitting at the controls, and over making the martinos is David North.
I'm here.
I can't figure martinos? I don't know what. Well, I can't figure this out. What kind of a man takes his wife's name?
That's true.
I'm trying to figure out David North Martino, David Martino, David North. Which sounds better? Maybe call
David
yourself
North, South, East, West.
Maybe call you. No, you're getting into Kanye West.
Oh
stuff,
no, that's
right?
True. No, I can't do that.
You can say yours is un. You know, un, or his baby, right? You look just like
yeah, that's right. I'm his love child.
Yeah, yeah. We have to figure out who your mother's going to be, but that's all right.
Oh,
Now, speaking of mothers, we have got a returning guest, and this time we're going to talk to him because this guy is multifaceted. Fawcett. He's written, of course, we talked to him about Al Capone and his brother and Two Gun Heart, and he does nonfiction, but he is... a relic in the world of fiction.
Wow. You put all that together.
Jeff MacArthur, thank you for being here.
Ah, thanks for having me again.
Well, there you go. Well, you're so good that people want you twice.
Oh, man, I can't believe that I didn't already talk your ear off.
Oh, it goes in through one and out the other, you know. Very, 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 very little in the middle here to catch anything, so I don't know.
You didn't lose all the audience before? You want to lose the rest of them?
No. They loved it so much, they actually had to play 3, 4, 5 times.
Oh, wow.
That's by popular demand.
Yeah, both people.
If only they'd read the book that many times.
Well, you know, that's just how it goes. I can never figure out a buying audience. I can never figure it out.
Yeah.
With books. It's kind of this whole world of... with Amazon and that last 10 years, how books sell, I have no idea. You know, certain ones will sell when you don't expect them to and years after, and then other ones, it's unpredictable.
You're exactly right. Actually, there was one time when I went on some national interview for something, and I was like, all right, I was watching the numbers expecting that's going to just like explode, it's going to be like this big thing or whatever, and it didn't, but one of my other books did. And it was like another book that I hadn't even promoted or anything like that. Just all of a sudden, like a ton of people. I'm like, where? Okay.
It's, you just don't know. I think all you can do, I think the best thing that we can do out there is just brand ourselves. But, you know, we just put ourselves out there. This is what I do. And you just kind of keep working it that way. And people pick up on you and what you do rather than, I don't know. I think that kind of works better because I can't explain it. Or either you could start putting your books under categories that are very, very little used, right? And so then you'll be number one in that category.
That actually does actually help. One of them that that kind of took off for a little bit, that was the thing. It was kind of in a more obscure thing. I was like, oh, nobody's going to find it in here. And sure enough, I don't remember what it was, but it was, it was under lawyers. It Perfect. Wasn't under true crime or law. It was lawyers.
Yeah.
Got a bunch of attention. I was like, all right, well, sure.
Yeah, I was going to put my newest book under basket weaving and see if it actually, you know, all I have to do is sell like 5 or 6 and I'll be number one.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's niches, you know, that's the thing. Is if you can get in with a niche, then that niche crowd will become passionate about it and, you know, pass it on to other people and stuff. And that actually, it does actually work that way. It's you know, I shouldn't say it works because somebody's going to go out there and expect it to work and then it won't, because we never know exactly what is going to work at 1 minute or the next, but a lot of times it does. I'd say that's one of the better marketing choices is to go after your niche crowd.
Yeah, the only problem is it doesn't always, you know, it doesn't always work. We just, talking about an author that just did one under a weird category there and the highest he made it was number 19 under the new releases. So,
yeah, exactly. So it's not going to work. It's not going to work every time. So nobody should expect it. But it's one of it's all you know, really. What all these things are. This was true with the book industry and the film industry and all that. It's you weight the dice as best you can and then you roll them. But you're still going to be rolling the dice. It's never going to be a sure thing.
So. Or you put new pictures in it.
That's true. You know, even then.
Well, they got to be good nudes, right? And it's, you know, I was thinking that, you know, have it where it's scratch and sniff, you know?
Oh, my God.
I don't know. Maybe not. But it's an idea.
I just pictured,
I bet you did.
it's now on the internet, and so I'm just picturing people going up to their screens and scratching their screens.
Hey, but you know what? Back in what in the 40s and stuff, they had smellorama in the theater.
Right,
that's right. True.
And then had the remember the Tickler? You know the that movie with Vincent Price. That horror one, wasn't it the Tickler or the whatever it was with that little creature that comes out of the spine? And so they had vibrators in the chairs.
I'm just picturing Vincent Price and the Tickler, just that the his face and the way he sounds.
Yeah, well,
mixed with that,
he probably had the real Tickler a few times.
Man,
yeah, and I didn't know. Well, anyway, that's a different story. But that, you know, so they could do it in a theater. They could do it they have some, I don't know. You have a little kit that you get box, has the smell in it. You can.
Yeah. Oh, man.
So,
wow.
Yeah, I know. I'm a sick one.
I'm very proud, actually.
Yeah, they might take me out and shoot me. Hey, so you into science fiction here, it looks like. So this Relic Worlds, so what is Relic Worlds?
Well, essentially, it's imagine if Indiana Jones was in space. I mean, I'm from that age. I was 6 years old when Star Wars came out. I grew up with Star Wars and Indiana Jones. And basically, at a certain point, I was like, what if these two mixed together, had a baby, and that's actually kind of sick. But anyway. Yeah.
I was going to say, it wasn't exactly what I was thinking.
Incest love child. But anyway, you get the idea. It's like what my generation grew up with is this idea of creativity. I'm trying to think of a better word than that, but just essentially, you know, like today you have a lot of things that are just sort of rehashed and all sort of thing. We kind of grew up with all of these stories that were original. And one of the things that really inspired me to get into stories in the first place was the idea of these more sort of original sort of stories. And anyway, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and this, if I mix them together, essentially it's this guy going around looking for ancient artifacts, inside of ruins on distant planets. So essentially going around, and basically the idea overall in terms of the world building is as humanity went out into the stars, they expected to run into aliens somewhere, but they didn't. They just kept settling on various planets, but they found the ruins of these ancient alien civilizations. And as they got to each one of them, for the most part, humanity didn't, the governments that were landing on them didn't care, because it was no longer governments like the U.S., Russia, all that. Instead, it's corporations. So it's, you know, you no longer live in United States territory, you live in Pepsi territory or whatever. And so when they get to these various different planets and see these ruins, instead of seeing them as, oh, here's this amazing, you know, find that we've located, instead it's, oh, we got to level that so we can put a super mall down or whatever. but there are a few various characters who go, wait a second, why are there ruins here and why aren't the aliens still here? And so yeah, there's where the main character comes in, Lancaster James, and he's essentially going to these various places and trying to get these artifacts out of there before they get leveled and putting them to be basically, they're like puzzle pieces. So he's trying to put them all together to figure out what happened to these alien races. And could the same thing that happened to them happen to us? And as the series goes along, you find various different characters who want to find these artifacts for different reasons. And then eventually the corporations start realizing they have some power, so you wind up in this big race with them. It's like an arms race with them trying to each get the more powerful ones. He's in the middle of it. It's the various people who kind of joined him are in the middle of it. And that's basically it. It's mainly the way I pitch it is it's Indiana Jones in space, but it becomes much more complex, much more of its own thing.
Yeah, but you call this Lancaster James and the salient seed of the galaxy. So what do you mean by that? I'm thinking of Soylent. So that's kind of an obvious, but who is Lancaster James? I'm trying to get a grasp on the character.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's book number four, and that one's just come out. It's just coming out. It's available for pre-sale. But he is, he's actually an anthropologist instead of an archaeologist. He's studied about, he's a xenoanthropologist. So he's studied about alien races, what little was known about them, again, because the universe that he's born into doesn't really value education very much, except for, like, how do you make money? But as little has been known, he's studied, he's become fascinated by, and he's kind of obsessed with, you know, learning about these alien races. But what he, you know, what he was educated by, what he learned was really thin, and so he has gone out and started finding, since the alien races themselves don't exist, so he can't really study them, he'd more like takes their artifacts and uses them to start understanding what they used to be. Now there are like barely sentient races that are out there, the races that have just barely started to evolve into some kind of sentient being or whatever, and so the other anthropologists that he knows, that's usually what they're studying, is like cavemen on different planets. But he's fascinated by, before that, the anthropology has been mostly studying them. But what he's fascinated by is, well, who were these alien races who used to exist, who used to be starfaring, who used to control the galaxy, who used to go to different places, who used to live in these gigantic ruins? And he used to be married to this woman named Mika Sanovi, who is an archaeologist, and she was fascinated with finding all the stuff, but she was more fascinated with just the stuff. She would find it and, like, sort of put them in her museum, and there are scenes where the two of them are in the museum, and she's like, okay, she's sort of organizing them in terms of the way they looked or whatever, you know, race they were. And he then gets annoyed and he starts rearranging them and going, no, this should be here, because he's putting more of them more in terms of the puzzle, in terms of figuring out how one race connected to another and how, you know, what happened to them and stuff like that. So yeah, he's basically a very, very passionate Indiana Jones kind of character, somebody who, instead of being very, you know, kind of gruff and grunting and all sort of thing, he's very passionate about what he does. And the reason why he and his wife divorced was because he was constantly going out and looking for the stuff, whereas she was kind of like, hey, let's just get this stuff and put it in our museum and sit at home and be comfortable and enjoy this. And then he goes out and he travels with his partner named Little Jack, who is this short guy who used to be one of the greatest. Well, he's kind of known as one of the most one of the best corporate spies ever to go around and do everything. And basically, he was like a gangster, like a spy, like an independent contractor, assassin, a thief, et cetera, but he kind of left that life behind because he saw what Lancaster was doing and felt that there was a little tiny noble side inside of him that admired that nobility. So he kind of covers Lancaster, because Lancaster, while he's very good at finding these relics and putting them together, he's not particularly good at fighting. So his partner, Little Jack, kind of protects him and helps him and that sort of thing.
So let me translate for the audience. So basically, Mika left Lancaster James because Little Jack was doing what she couldn't.
Sora, she didn't. It's funny. For a second there, I thought you were actually going to say that what actually really does exist between them is there's this animosity between the two, in that she never really liked this guy, never really trusted him. She's very much of the straight-laced, you know, she's a professor at the university, do everything the right way, whereas here's this little gangster guy comes along. And, you know, doesn't talk very much. And so for the first three books, there's always this tenseness between them. In some way, she feels like he stole Lancaster away from her, because he kind of, like, even though he wasn't into all the artifacts and that sort of thing, he was certainly interested in helping Lancaster go and find them. But in this latest book, in book four, is where she and he have the breakthrough and actually start to have a connection and all that sort of thing. And it was some of the most fun when I was actually writing that, because I was like, I wasn't sure where to put, you know, what to do next. And then all of a sudden I realized, oh, wait, I don't have anything for Little Jack to do right now. I don't have anything for Mika to do right now. It's time these two hook up. Well, okay, not like that, but it's time for these two to like, have their breakthrough and get to know each other as people and that sort of thing.
Did you have to do any special type of research, or did you have to kind of extrapolate out to create this type of alien archaeology?
That's a really good question, because yes, thank you for asking that, because most of the time when people ask about this sort of thing, it's well, you're just creating alien species, you're just sort of, you know, making everything up, and so it's, you know, it's completely in your head.
That's a good question. I can't believe you even said the word extrapolate.
Exactly.
I have a dictionary here. That's pretty good.
But, yes, because here's the thing is, and this is why I always end up, because I'm always thinking, oh, good, I'm going to get back to Relic Worlds, because, like, as you say, I write various different books, and whenever I get back to Relic Worlds, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is going to be easy. It's just an adventure story, you know, all that sort of thing. And then I get into it and start realizing, oh, wait, I don't want this to just be obvious BS. I don't want it to be just like, oh, there's this. I want everything to, you know, connect, for one thing. And I want that to make some sense. So, like, for instance, with this latest one, he gets closer than he ever has. Well, each book he gets closer than he ever has to an ancient alien race. And, you know, I mean, even something as simple as a chair, it's like I've had scenes where somebody goes into a room, an ancient room, and there's like some furniture there. I'm like, but it wouldn't be just a couch. You know, it'd be like, you know, like for instance, this race has a tail. And I'm like, okay, so what would their chair look like? What would you know, and everything has to be. And so as a result, I ended up looking at various alien races, various different
alien furniture stores.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, human ones, you know, or not human ones, Earth, you know, creatures or whatever. And like, okay, how can I mix and match? But I also don't want it to just purely be, okay, this is a lizard in space. It's like I want to, you know, make it something a little bit more different. So, you know, I even go to the source of, well, okay, what makes life exist? What are the three, you know, what are the various ingredients that creates life? And so how can I create something more? How can I have something that doesn't just necessarily have even a mouth? Maybe it breathes a different way. Maybe it eats a different way. In this latest one, it's an alien race that was both on the surface and in the water. So I was going into a lot of the sea life, and my God, some of the sea life we have here on Earth, it's just, it's alien already. So, you know, taking various aspects of that and, you know, putting them in, and then there's their technology, which I'm like, okay, yes, partly it's what I make up. So in some ways, I want it to be almost magical because it's supposed to be something beyond what humans could comprehend how to make. And oftentimes, magic would be, or oftentimes when a technology is further away, it would just seem like magic. Because, like, imagine taking a cell phone to the 1500s, you know. So it would, you know, in many ways it's just that. But I also am like, I want to have some way that things actually work, or some at least theoretical idea, especially when it comes to human technology or whenever humans have made it work for them. So, yeah, there's a lot of, I end up just having like almost a college education every time I write one of these books, because I'm like, all right, I'm reading about astrophysics, and then I'm reading about biology, and then I'm all for this, you know, fun adventure book. But, you know, I always have to alter them to work in the books, and then I have to describe it to the audience, because there's no actual English word for a lot of these things. I have to kind of, I'll like have some word there, and then I'll explain what it is. So yeah, it's they're basic adventure books, but they have a ton of research behind them, probably more than a lot of my nonfiction books.
Yeah, yeah. Lots of sex in it.
You know, I have to, that is one place where I have even asked parents, if after you read this, please tell me, because I'd like to hear, because I've never had a kid myself, I don't have any actual sex, but it is like, I ride the line. I've oftentimes said it's about at the level of like Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. If you remember that, not that it's that quality. It's definitely a better, like that. I don't consider that to be a particularly good movie. But if you've ever seen it, that movie literally created the PG-13 rating, because it's like, well, it's more than PG, but it's not quite an R. You know, there's literally the secret door in which he goes into the way he gets into this room is he grabs the boobs on this statue. You know, there's a scene where a guy's heart gets ripped out. So it's like it rode the line, and it was right on that line. And that's basically where I wanted this, where it's like entertaining for adults. And but you know, I figured, okay, this will be for like teenagers and above. And unfortunately, when I go to conventions and I'm showing it off, it's always the little kids who run up and are like really fascinated and excited. And I'm like, maybe I should have written this just for little kids.
Yeah, so cut the cock out. And
exactly. I mean, there, you know, there's never an actual sex scene, but it's implied. Like, there's a scene where a woman is seducing a man, and I'm like, is that going to play well to 10-year-olds? But then again, I watched the Temple of Doom when I was, 11 or something like that, and it didn't scar me or anything. I was just kind of like weirded out by it. So I think it's fine. It's just, especially today's, you know, more sensitive. But I did write a series then of choose your own adventure books, specifically meant for that crowd, to be like, okay, if the main books are a little much for you guys, then, you know, here's the choose your own adventure books. And I made sure those were totally clean.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fine, because I think the kids aren't near as naive as we were. You know?
Yeah.
Well, maybe not, but I just think they're probably a little more. I mean, look at what they see on Netflix and
right.
stuff. Right? You know, it's pretty graphic in these sci-fi movies and pretty intimate.
Yeah. So, that's how I feel, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, it couldn't be that bad, you know. I mean, it shouldn't terrify them that much. But how deep can you go in relationships then in a book like this?
Right, that's a very good point, because it, you know, on the one hand, in terms of like, you know, in terms of age for kids and all that sort of thing, you usually don't want to go too much. But again, I was thinking teenagers and above, so I would be like, okay, it's fine to go into any amount of detail. The issue, though, then becomes, am I boring the audience? Because I'm always asking that with this series. And again, more than any others, because with the others, it's easy. It's like, okay, nonfiction, somebody came here to read about this subject. Okay, you know, about what is the story behind what happened here, you know, with the American Game, which was a historical fiction. People who are interested in, you know, people who are in warfare coming together, you know, stick to that. With this, it starts as a basic adventure story, but that there's only so far that can go. A treasure hunt only goes so far. You need to then get into some kind of interpersonal relationship just to get, you know, keep it interesting. Or, you know, audiences are going to get bored. I mean, there's a really good reason why in the Indiana Jones series, in the third one, they introduced the father. Because it's like, you can't just have somebody just going treasure hunting after treasure hunting after treasure hunting. So you have this on, and I, in this particular case, I set this ridiculous goal for myself to have 9 books, partly because it's supposed to be just an ongoing storyline, but also I have this rise and fall of what basically overall happens with, you know, one of the alien races and human civilization, etc. So I need to have some relationships going on. So I have the, you know, with the interpersonal thing between him and his ex-wife, the way that his partner grows and the, that, you know, the way that friendship exists, and then the, some of the other characters. But, oh, what was it?
His name was, what was his name? His partner's name?
Little Jack.
Yeah, Little Jack. So he grew up to be Big Jack.
Well, he actually, part of the idea is that he is, he's a little person, basically, he's, you know, he's like right around that size. He also has eye problems. He's one of the only people who wears glasses. And the idea is supposed to be that he's sort of this almost deformed kind of person, particularly in an age when you can, when people can have a lot of these issues fixed when they're little kids. But that's supposed to be physical signs of, like, the way his parents sort of abused them and that they didn't care enough to get all of these fixes that you can get. I shouldn't say fixes. But you know what I mean. It's all of these alterations you can have so that you wind up having, you know, perfect eyesight and, you know, I mean, we already have, like, you know, laser eye surgery and that sort of thing. My idea is that a few hundred years in the future, that's going to be kind of like getting your vaccine when you're a little kid. It's like, well, most people, except for anti-vaxxers, do that for their kids. It'll probably be the same kind of thing that, you know, everybody kind of has their eyes fixed. Everybody has, you know, any genetic issues sort of dealt with. But there are a few people like Little Jack who just, their parents just didn't care about them enough. So that goes into the whole relationship thing, like you're saying. So I always am sort of wrestling with how much do I go into the personal relationships and how much is that interfering with the adventure story that people came for, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. And so are you worried about political correctness through a story like this, Fett?
Great point, especially now because of the fact that I came into this, you know, in an earlier era. I mean, I've had this in my mind literally since like the late 90s. Actually, I'll tell you a story here in a second, in a little bit about how the birth of this actually had to do with the movie Titanic. But so this goes way, way back. And again, you know, I grew up during this era where it was just simply, you know, here are these stories and we're just going to have fun with them or whatever. You know, and he's the type of archetype that dates all the way back to like the 30s. And so now there is kind of this sense of, well, we're moving on to other kinds of characters, which I understand a bit more. But then you also have the oversensitivity of a lot of people being, you know, wanting to nitpick on every little thing you do. And there's, you know, I mean, there's a little bit of that I sympathize with, because it's like, okay, yeah, I do believe in the idea of stories evolving and becoming, changing, I'm trying to think of a different word other than evolving, but essentially evolving into other ideas, but also being sensitive to various groups. I don't want to make fun of anybody or put them down and stuff like that. But at the same time, sometimes people will take something that was like meant for an alien race and they'll put it on themselves and then be like, well, you're making fun of us through this. And I'm like, no, I just meant it to be this other thing. Now, I have not run into that myself, but I oftentimes do become afraid of that when I see people really jumping on other projects and going, oh, wait, I have a character that's kind of like that, or I have an alien race that's a little like that. And I can see those same people criticizing this for the same reason. So it does make me careful in some good ways, but in other ways, it's like, yeah, I have to stop and just go, you know what? I just have to tell the story and not be worried about what every person's going to think.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Track of all your characters, storylines, your different science elements. Do you have a process for that?
Basically, I have extensive notes like written all over the place. However, I have to admit that this book in particular, I found it really challenged how many notes I had because there were a lot of places where I had to refer to some things, and I started looking back and realizing, oh, wait, when I was writing that, I was just in the zone. And because that's the thing, sometimes when you're writing, you're just so much in the zone that you don't want to stop. But, of course, as you're writing, you're also establishing certain aspects that are going to be needed later on. You're putting in certain names of objects or, you know, certain ways that certain things work. And if you don't stop writing and right away and go and write that as a note, you're going to forget it later. You just, you know, but that's the thing is sometimes I'm in the zone and I just get right through and I don't think to write it down later. And so there were times later where in this book in particular where I was writing along and I'm like, wait a minute, I established that somewhere. I looked through my notes, I couldn't find it. So I just went back to the earlier books and I had to do, the find and replace type thing. I just did a whole search for, those aspects for what those words or what those words were, but of course not knowing what the words were, I had to think of a word close to it. So like, for instance, the name of a planet. So I was like, all right, well, I'll look up the word planet. So in case I said the planet such and such, you know, whatever. Okay, didn't do that. Maybe I said star system or whatever system, you know, whatever. And I have to basically go through all the books until I find that planet name, you know, and come back. So, now that this book is done, it was such a headache having to go through and find all those words. After this is done, I'm actually going to be going through and going through every book and, you know, writing down all the notes. And it's just in time, too, because I'm actually going to be making a role-playing game version of it. So that'll all go into there. So people playing the role-playing game, it's like, okay, well, that's all the notes. And the RPG will probably be my notes of, you know, of everything, because, you know, they'll need that, too.
Well, you're a busy man.
I do way too much.
Where do you get your characters from? But like, they sound, it's pretty developed. Like, your little Jack and then Mika and stuff. Where do they come from? People you know?
Yeah. Wow. Really good questions. Well, I mean, of course, Lancaster is basically the archetype kind of adventure character. I mean,
that's you.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, yeah. I mean, it's the adventure character that, you know, exists for a long time. I keep saying, you know, I say Indiana Jones a lot because that's what I grew up with, but of course, he is also a product of a lot of the, you know, archetype characters or whatever. And yeah, you can never help but have yourself somehow placed into them. I was saying, Lancaster's very passionate. I had actually originally intended him to be more of a gruff kind of, you know, low-key kind of character. But I found myself writing him so passionately that I was like, oh, yeah, okay, that's, I guess, my piece, you know, placed into there. The Little Jack character, you know, to be honest with you, I don't even remember where a lot of these characters came from. There's this whole long history that, like, the very, very first place where I started coming up with it, it was before Lord of the Rings had come out. And I was like, how about a sci-fi version of Lord of the Rings? And so, you know, I had, like, was creating all these characters from that kind of thing, from some of those archetypes. And, of course, one of them is Small because it's the Hobbits. And that character kind of eventually, over all these years, evolved into Little Jack. But in many ways, it comes back to there was a my best friend when I was a kid was this kid who had cancer who, because of the treatment that he had, he never grew. And so he was always really short. And I found myself, as I've been writing, making a lot of the dynamics of those two characters very much of what we were. Mika, there's a lot of aspects of an ex-girlfriend of mine that's in her, that was very, you know, studious and very, you know, concentrated on one thing or another. But, of course, then the story itself ends up readjusting, you know, as things goes along because of the fact that they run into one thing. And I mean, it's very much like pool balls running into one another and readjusting one another's trajectory. And so they may start one way, or they may have started completely a different way, but I found myself writing them one way, but then they hit each other, and then they change into slightly different people. So in many ways, they've dictated themselves. But yeah, there definitely are, you know, there's one couple who actually is based on a porn couple.
Called the Insane. You don't watch porn.
Well, no, I one time was hired onto a quote unquote B movie. Showed up to there to find, yeah, I was working on a porn. So I was actually the driver. They couldn't park at the actual location. They had to be driven up. And then after a while, they had me working at the front desk, basically handing out, contracts and just basically holding on to any paperwork. And two of the people who worked there was this couple that referred to themselves as the Insanity Twins. It was Roxanne Hall, and I don't remember the guy's name, but they were two of the funniest people I've ever met. They were so hilarious. She went around with a keychain with Polaroid pictures of every woman that her husband had sex with. Like anytime that he was in a movie, she had to go there and take a picture of them and stuff. And just was they were so full of life and so crazy and so interesting. And then later on, many years later, when I'm writing this thing, I had to have a couple of people from Little Jack's past, and instead of having just the typical gangsters that are like worked up, I wanted them to be kind of this very extreme. And so I took the Insanity Twins and made them into this. And my girlfriend read the characters and didn't like them because she's like, why are you calling them twins when they're so, you know, they're married. They're a married couple. You're implying incest. And I'm like, no. It's just that they're so much alike, like each other that, you know, so yeah.
Wow, you're just. But it sounds like you're putting a lot of your personal self into this. It's like when you talk about some of the characters, they're emotional parts of you.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, when you do that, do you have a problem? How do you say developing that on paper?
That is, man, yeah, you guys are full of really good questions today. You're absolutely, that is really, you know.
We are the full of it channel.
You know, and I apologize for kind of stammering and rambling, but it's like you're really making me think quite a bit because you are right. Or actually, there's part of me that's also like, okay, how much do you actually want to tell Jeff?
Yeah. Well, but, next we're going to pull out the pictures. So.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, no, you're absolutely right because the reason why that's such a good question is normally with a book series like this, you'd be like, oh, it's an adventure series. It's just for fun, blah, blah, blah. But I have actually specifically said, maybe Jamie has talked to you because I've actually said this exactly to her, where, you know, I'll look at her and I'll be like, I'm surprised at how emotional this is making me. I'm surprised at how much this is pulling out of me. And there was another author who asked me, of all the books I've ever written, what's the book that you would most want to be preserved? If all of them were going to be destroyed, but only one could remain, I said, maybe American Game, but probably Relic Worlds, if the entire series could be considered as one series. Because there's so much of me that's come out from this. And I think it's just because it digs down so much to the roots of who I am. I mean, it literally goes back to when I was six and what made me become a storyteller to begin with. It was literally watching these, you know, movies when I was a little kid, and then buying the action figures and creating towns with them and like moving around. And, you know, like my whole childhood was put into creating these stories with this friend of mine I was talking about who was really short, and I grew unusually tall at the time. And so, you know, it's very much what we created has slowly evolved into what this is. I mean, and the way that this got started, like I said, that time in the late 90s where basically somebody said, you know, hey, come up with a sci-fi series, you know, and pitch it to us. I had to do it kind of quickly. I had to come up with something kind of quick. And it was almost like, okay, what are all the things from my childhood that, you know, made me love sci-fi, and put it all into one? And it's all kind of worked its way in somehow into this, whether consciously or unconsciously. So yeah, there's so much just personally of, you know, coming from like the, I guess the deep psyche or whatever, that has come out into this. Again, just, it's mainly supposed to be just sort of an adventure series, but also kind of exploring the views of, my views of the galaxy. And in the end, the actual, I can't really say what it is because that'd be spoilers for the end, but the final view of this is basically my view of the galaxy, of the universe. So, you know, as pretentious as it sounds, but it, the end of this is literally going to be the way that I view humanity and our place in the universe and all of that. So,
You know, when they ask me what book I would keep if everything was ruined, I always say the one with the most pages, because it's going to last longer in the bathroom, right?
That's a good point.
Yeah. Be realistic. If everything is being ruined, I'm going to need my toilet paper.
Well, leaving something behind of myself. If somebody wants to know the deep psyche of me or whatever, like who I was and in this earth after I'm gone, honestly, I'd say Relic Worlds. As bizarre as that is, as much as it's just sort of, it's so much not what you'd think to be a psychological exploration, it is of me. It is of what is, you know, is going on deeply inside me, I guess.
Yeah, but doesn't that worry you when you expose yourself like that?
It does, you know, and especially, you know, in this particular case, it's a little easier, though, and I think that's the thing, is sci-fi and fantasy works best when it is symbolic, when it's saying something through something else. It's almost like that psychologist's trick where they have you speak through puppets. It's like there are things that I want to say, but I can't say it, so I say it through my puppet. It's, you know, and I can say it through fantasy, I can say it through science fiction, I can say it through these stories, but I can't really say it out loud. And actually, strangely enough, I'm actually writing another book. One of my next books that I'm writing is actually about that kid I keep talking about from my childhood, is literally about him. And that one's super, super, super hard to get through because I'm approaching it directly. And there are real people who, you know, will be affected by it and stuff. But I can say things about him and about myself through these other characters much safer, even though there's a part of me that knows I'm exposing something, because it's somewhat disguised, it makes it a little easier.
Right, right. But so this sounds like it's an intricate part of the whole series. Yeah. You know, these personal things, it's kind of a subtext in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, it's partly because, you know, in order to keep things going, you need the personal aspect going, but also, that's really what a story is for us when we're reading it. We want to connect with someone, not just what someone does, you know.
Mm. Do you actually look for that sort of thing? Like when you're reading or when you're writing, do you actually try to make sure your character is very accessible, very relatable?
Yes, I absolutely want to make sure that people at least will care, because that's ultimately that's really what it comes down to. Because what really made it challenge me was the sort of the rise of the antihero, especially in several series that have come along. It's like, why do we care? For instance, why do we care about Walter White? I guess I go back to series again rather than a book series, but most of us know that more. Why do we care about Walter White? Well, partly because we grew to care about him at the beginning when he was more likable. But that's the thing, is it's just ultimately we have to put it bluntly, we have to...
Oh, my.
It isn't even so much of we have to like the person or love the person or want... It's just we have to care about what they're going through. And so that is something I always try to really make be careful of, is wherever somebody's going, whatever somebody's doing, the audience just has to get...
Oh, my.
...what they're doing. So...
Yeah, that is important. So do you actually have something you want people to take out of this series?
Yes. I mean, first, you know, I want them to have a good time. I want them to have fun, you know, et cetera. That is sort of the surface level.
Yeah.
Exactly. but also to expand the mind, there are a number of things I want them to take out of it that are spoilers, unfortunately. But... I without giving spoilers, I think I can safely say I want the audiences to, or I want readers to read it, to take away from it an expansion of an idea. Because it was like I was saying about the alien races. I don't want to just simply have, okay, well, this is a lizard man. It's like, well, what more is there about them that is, and what is it that about them that humans can't even have? Like, their character, the way that a lot of the alien species speak to each other is a completely different method. The way that they experience the universe. There's one alien race that I made absolutely certain they have no eyes, nor do they even have any type of visual sensor they have. The way they experience the universe is through shooting out the little particles, and they go out and then have to bounce back to them, sort of like the way bats will do sound waves for them. It's particle beams, and, you know, bounce back to them. And the way that they experience everything is completely different. And then there's, you know, other the underwater race I was just dealing with. They are used to being able to communicate with one another halfway across the planet because of the way the water waves can go across, you know, much further. Whales can speak to each other much further away. So in that, that's more of an obvious way of looking at it. It's like, okay, look at the way aliens would experience the universe in a completely different way, and then take that also to humanity and understand humans see things in completely different ways, even though we have the same sensory organs. Because of the point of view, because of where you, who you are, you're going to experience things in different ways. And I purposely do that in the book, where there'll be like one chapter from one person's point of view, then I'll go to a completely different person's point of view, and the scene will almost come across as a different scene, even though some of it overlaps. And part of the point of that is supposed to be the parallel of, just as we're seeing aliens who experience life differently than each other and from us, so too do we humans experience life differently from one another.
So. Now, there's been some discussion lately with writers and writing and how they process story. And some writers have like an inner monologue in their head. Like, you know, I always joke around that I hear voices in my head and I transcribe. I transcribe those voices. And other writers see images and symbols. And I was just wondering how it is for you.
I do, just like you, I transcribe. And in fact, that's literally my day job, is I transcribe interviews. But when I write, I basically transcribe. I mean, essentially, I come up with the ideas. I spend long time, sometimes months, in a few cases, sometimes years, thinking through something. In the case of Relic Worlds, actually the first Relic Worlds novel, I had all the pieces and I knew basically what I wanted to do, but I couldn't put them all together. I could not put the pieces together. I had no idea how I wanted to do it. And then it was literally while I was driving, my girlfriend and I were driving out to Las Vegas for for New Year's Eve, and we were going to go visit there's a friend of ours who, her family lives out there. So we were going to this friend's family's home. And we're driving in the middle of the night. I usually listen to audiobooks. Jamie didn't really want to, and she kind of fell asleep. And if I put anything on, I was going to wake her up and stuff. And so I just kind of, my mind started wandering, driving, you know what it's like, driving between here and Vegas, dark, nothing around. And my mind started to wander, and literally all the pieces just fell into place. And I literally could see, that it was like watching a movie. I just literally saw the entire story take place during that drive. And I was still, well, I got to the end, and I was still about an hour away from Vegas. And I'm like holding it in while I'm driving as fast as I can, like trying to get there as quickly as possible. We get to the home, knock on the door. This person answers the door, not our friend. Her father answers the door, someone we've never met, and she's like, hi, you must be Jeff and Jamie. I'm like, yes, do you have a pen and paper? Oh, no, it was her mother, because, yeah, which winds up being more ironic later on, but and she says, yeah, here, and she took me in, and I just sat there, and while Jamie and, you know, all the rest of them sat down and chatted, and they all got to know each other, I just sat there and literally wrote out the entirety of the first book, the entire synopsis of the first book right there in front of them, and I got done. I was like, done! And, you know, just then they were all going to bed. Ironically, that woman who answered the door, the friend's mother, is the subject of the first chapter of Dirty Old War. I learned later they were Vietnamese royalty, and so they had this whole escape from Vietnam story and stuff. But anyway, and so basically from there, I took the synopsis and I was able to write it. I mean, because of course that was still just a synopsis, but once I have a synopsis, it's almost like I can then play it back in my mind and I'm seeing it in my mind's eye while I'm just kind of transcribing, you know, what happened. So
at first I thought you said dirty old horror. Not that's the first thing you're, oh my, that's
for the audience, it's dirty old war, in case I made it sound different.
Well, no, I was thinking that's a terrible thing to think of, like, you know, if it's your girlfriend's mother, you know, my first thing I thought about, I wrote a whole chapter about her in Dirty Old War. It's like, wow, how's that relationship going?
Oh my god.
My word. You know what? But point of view, like when you say you write it from a different point of view, I've been noticing that a lot in sci-fi. Is that sort of becoming a trend or something? Like, because I don't do sci-fi. I haven't written in that area, but is that sort of becoming popular or something?
That's a good question. I've been saying that every time. Sorry. I tend to read, either stuff from a while ago or, independent books that just come out and stuff. I have noticed that a couple times, but, I guess I haven't read enough to really know if it has or not. I'm kind of selfish that way. I'm always so involved in whatever I'm writing, and I usually read something related to what I'm writing. So if I'm writing sci-fi, I'm reading sci-fi. If I'm writing, nonfiction, I'm usually reading the research for that. But I do notice that more people tend to go into the point of view of the minds of the characters more than they were. I think maybe that's where we are as a culture, because I was noticing when I was reading, I noticed it more from reading older material, because I've noticed a lot of the older books that I read tend to be like, hey, there was this, they went in a spaceship, or, you know, that's sort of a lame example, but they will oftentimes say, something that was used, and almost like that's expected to be the thing that's amazing. And at that time, it was. The idea of a suggestion of, it's almost like the further back you go, the more it's just like the basics of it. So it's like a ghost appeared, and it's like that in itself is scary, because at that time it was the suggestion was much more unusual. But now it's like, okay, we're used to that. It's not enough just to have a scary villain now. What do we know about the scary villain? Why are they a scary villain? It's not enough just that somebody found some ancient artifact. You know, now it's like, well, what is that artifact? Why is that artifact the way it is? I think today, if you were to go back and do the Indiana Jones stories again, it'd be more like, okay, why is the Ark like this? You know, why is, you know, I think more people are interested in the whys and what fors of individuals and of the things that they interact with.
Yeah. Now, okay, so let's get this out before it's over. Do you have your website or your location, mm-hmm. where you like people to come find you, date, whatever?
Yes, it's relicworlds.com is where you can find everything involved in Relic Worlds. It's the short stories, the novels, games, choose your own adventure books, everything. I have my own site, bandwagononline.com, that has like all my books, but everything Relic Worlds is in relicworlds.com.
Wow. We will put that up on our site as well. You know, it's been
cool.
Been quite the show. You know, we've been, what a guest. Our guest. Wow, Jeff MacArthur, and we've been talking Relic Worlds, and what did we learn? We learned that he worked in a porn movie called Dirk Diggler, and he likes to expose himself.
They asked me to be in one, and they were like, oh, well, you can be in, you know, because apparently I looked like somebody from one of the movies they were going to do. And he's like, oh, they offered that, and then they said, you don't have to have sex. And I'm like, that's taking away the one reason why.
Yeah. Why else would I be here? Come on.
Yeah.
You know, but it's been, we've learned a lot, and geez, I didn't know. So, you know, porn star writes books about his dirty old whore mother, stepmother.
There's one story I think you guys will enjoy if we have a little, couple minutes time. So where Relic Worlds originally, the very, very first source of it comes from, it's literally its birth because of the fact that it's not really what it actually is now, but it's where it started from, was, I went to NYU and afterwards my class was invited to go, I'm trying to think of how to describe it. When you graduate from somewhere, you are alumni. Okay. So alumni, there was some, I was the alumni of this class. Sorry?
Question for 200.
Yeah, I apologize. I'm kind of stammering through this. I'm glad you can edit these things. Anyway, so there was a special effects company, invited a bunch of alumni from NYU this one particular year. And so I went, on a thing and they were doing the special effects for a Titanic at the time. And they gave us this whole long tour, and at the end of it, they sat us down and they said, there's an ulterior motive for us to show this to you. And they took us into this private room they called the Whale, was this meeting room. And they like, because they could seal it off and everything, and they didn't want this to get out. And they went, so we're working on this movie, and it is going to be a gigantic flop. They're like, this movie Titanic is going to just completely flop. It's not going to go anywhere. It's going to be the end of James Cameron. And we currently have a contract with him, but when this movie fails, he's not going to be able to afford to keep us anymore. So we want to be able to go off on our own. And so we want movies to be, or we want to have some movies to be, what do you call it? To basically be able to develop ourselves and go off and do ourselves. And something that uses a lot of special effects. So if you have pitches, please, come back with them or whatever. So I went home and, over that weekend was like, okay, I got to come up with something quickly because this Titanic movie is going to come out and it's going to fail really soon. So I want them to, have my thing in there right away. So when they go off on their own, they'll be. So I threw all this stuff together. It was like, well, what is it that, is sort of can be reworked, retooled from my generation? I thought of Lord of the Rings, and I was like, all right, do a sci-fi version of that, because you want it to be something with a lot of special effects and et cetera, et cetera. So basically I came up with this whole kind of pitch. It is not like it is now. It was like a completely kind of different thing, but I sent it into them, and then Titanic came out, and I never heard from those guys again.
Oh, no.
They would never return the calls of any of us who were there. They pretended we never existed, and that conversation never happened.
Yeah, that would have been time to have your iPhone and filming it, if there was one back,
uh-huh.
Jesus. Well, anyway.
Yep. There are times I really, during my whole life, that I really wish I had been taken, because I'm like, I was there when this happened. Oh, my God.
Yeah. So. Well, what can I say? It never, never, never fails to entertain. Our guest today, Jeff MacArthur. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.